Hello, everybody. Welcome.
Doing the recording?
Yeah.
Okay, good.
Welcome, Lechnard, Jen Lechnard. He will speak today about Apache CouchDB, Sync, and Deep Dive. Thank you.
Hi, thank you. Who of you were at my talk yesterday? Oh, who? So you've seen the talk then. That's good. Okay. Who wasn't at my talk? All right, okay. So for the ones who were here, the first 5 to 7 minutes are going to be a bit of a recap, but it's very short. Don't fall asleep. My name is Apache CouchDB. that's my state of mind right now. My name is Jan Lehnert. I've been with CouchDB since 2006, started Apache CouchDB in 2008. I've had my 10-year anniversary a couple of weeks ago. I'm the PMC chair and VP of Apache CouchDB since 2011, and I'm the longest active contributor. And I've done everything with CouchDB, from evangelizing like this, community work, and core engineering, and I'm still doing all of this. I'm also the CEO and co-founder of Neighborhoody Software. If you ever need professional services, like evaluating whether CouchDB is the right database for you, you can hire us for this. So this is going to start with a short introduction to CouchDB. Again, please don't fall asleep if you've seen this. I'll keep it very short. If you haven't seen it, again, and you're still here for ApacheCon EU, today at 2:30, I'm giving this is the big introduction to CouchDB talk again. So you can come there, and I'll explain everything in detail again. This is the high-level marketing pitch for CouchDB. Is the mic loud? Too loud, maybe? A little bit?
I guess it's okay.
Is it okay? Okay, sorry. It's louder than yesterday, so I'm a bit confused. Seamless multi-master synchronization that scaled from big data to mobile with an intuitive HTTP JSON API designed for reliability. Lots of buzzwords. Today, we only care about the synchronization bit. Just very briefly, basics. The main protocol for CouchDB is HTTP. A lot of benefits of HTTP, specialized hardware, software that you can use for load balancing, failover, monitoring. If you tell your operations people, hey, here's a new HTTP software, can you set that up? They will say yes, because they already know how that works. That's really good. It uses JSON for storage. JSON has the nice property that it doesn't try to be all data structures that all programming languages can provide, kind of what XML tried, but it's the subset of all the primitives that all programming languages share, like strings, integers, lists, and maps, which is really convenient. We call a data record a document. There's other document databases. They stole that term from us. We stole the term from Lotus Notes. Don't tell anyone. Documents are identified by IDs, and versions of documents are addressed by what we call content addressable revisions, and I'll explain all about this in this talk. Quickly continuing, to do querying for CouchDB, we have a rather unique incremental and persistent MapReduce system. Again, the other talk goes into how that actually works. Another unique feature of Couch is what we call the changes feed. It's a real-time feed into what is happening in your database that you can subscribe to. It works kind of like Git log or SVN log, all the things that happened since the beginning of time in the database as a real-time HTTP feed that lets you connect CouchDB to a whole lot of other things, which is really nice too. CouchDB can run on a single node and a cluster version, and both versions are API compatible. In fact, there's no two versions. A single node CouchDB instance is just a cluster with one node. So you can grow, the usage of your application can grow and the database can grow with you without you having to rewrite the database. Most other databases don't do that, which is really nice. The downside is the single node version doesn't have any features, or CouchDB in general doesn't have any features that would stop working at scale. Other databases have all the features, because some features you can only do if you run on a single node machine, and they stop working once you use them at scale, which is kind of annoying, because as more important as your application goes, the more you have to rewrite it to not use the features that these databases use. Kind of like companies like Google and Facebook use MySQL a lot, but they don't use extensive joins because that's not fast enough for their scale. So it's nice that they have complex join operations, but if you use it at scale, you can't use it anymore. Quick run through the design decisions. Data safety is number one priority for CouchDB. It's very important in the synchronization case. I'll explain that later again. There's a lot of databases that say they synchronize, and then they just throw data away randomly, which is it's a curious design decision for a database, but other systems just like to do this. It's also designed for fault tolerance. It uses Erlang, which does process isolation per request. So if anything goes wrong with any of, say, 1,000 concurrent requests, only the one request that encounters the error is going to get the error message back. All the other ones are logically isolated. They will never see that there was anything else going on. Has a crash-only design, so after a catastrophic failure, it can start up and start working right away. There's no fix-up phase for the data. It's always consistent on disk. All the long-running operations in CouchDB are resumable and checkpointed, so you never lose any of the data, any of the computations that may have been ongoing. And all the requests are idempotent, so if you do them a couple of times, the end result is always the same. Now, here's a bunch of, and like most of you have seen this too, a bunch of our topologies for how you could deploy CouchDB. So this could be a single node CouchDB or a cluster of multiple nodes CouchDB in a data center. I don't have like different diagrams for single node or cluster. So this could be, again, a cluster or a single node. This could be a topology where you have a hot spare failover. This could be two different availability zones for a cloud provider. So you have a cross availability zone availability for your database here. This setup is supported by most other databases as well. If you need to scale your read requests, it's kind of a thing from a bygone era, but sometimes you still have this, you can build this as well. But this is where it gets interesting. You can have a full like multi-primary database that you can write to at the same time concurrently. And some databases support this as well, but this is where they most throw their hands up in the air and say, okay, we don't support this anymore. In CouchDB, this is the default case. You can have as many nodes as you want communicating in any way you like and have anyone be a primary node that you could, that users can actively write to. And these, again, could be regions in your cloud provider, so the data is closer to US, East, US West, and Europe customers if you wanted to. Or you have a smaller deployment that is maybe per office. You have an office in Sevilla, in New York, and Tokyo. Everybody in their office only ever talks to the local database. So they have low latency and fast access, good user experience, but they have access to all the data that comes in from all the other countries. But people in Tokyo never have to wait for the latency to go to New York or Sevilla for any data record. There's lots of fun stuff that you can do there. If you take that to an extreme, I don't have a slide for this. This also works on mobile. So if you have thousands and thousands of mobiles or hundreds of thousands of mobile customers, they can also have that data on their device at all times and have really good user experience and know only when they're connected to the internet, synchronized back to your cloud backend if they wanted to. Here's another one that we're currently designing for a customer. And a federal system, cities in Germany are responsible for fixing all the public infrastructure like bridges and roads. But no, they all have management software for this, but no city trusts any other city with the data, so they all have their own copy of this. But then the counties need to be able to look at the data across cities. Maybe there's a cross-city connection of streets that need to be worked on together. There's a state level, of course, and the country level. Maybe just get the statistics for everything and do the budgeting. But all of this can be built up. Same infrastructure, but in a corporate situation, this is also a customer that we're doing. All the tills in a supermarket in Italy, for example, run CouchDB that goes to the headquarters or the main office of the supermarket that has the internet uplink to the headquarters, and the regional manager can then do stock and budgeting and all that kind of stuff, and the corporate level at the top can see what's going on overall. And then bear with me, the next one looks a bit maybe over the top, but if you consider an Internet of Things situation with lots of small devices, and maybe less in a home scenario where I have a couple, but maybe in an industry scenario, so I'm calling this Industry of Things, think of lots of tiny sensors that measure something maybe like air quality in an oil refinery, then having a big mesh network of replicating data is really useful because most of these industries, like industrial plants, are not connected. I don't have internal networking and are not connected up to any public internet. So that way you can collect a lot of data that wasn't previously available and move that all into the cloud for big data analysis and whatever else you need. So this is kind of the use cases where you can use CouchDB really nicely and where it's been set apart from other databases. But now what we're looking at is the arrows here in all the diagrams. How does the synchronization actually work? And I have this sort of famous tweet, friends don't let friends build their own crypto sync database, because we all know this is each of those is a lot of work, and we don't want to push friends off a cliff. It's easy to underestimate the effort that goes into solving any one of these. And then a friend of mine got me because I'm writing. So I have a database that does synchronization, so I'm bound to do a crypto thing next. But there's a problem with this thinking of not letting friends astray. Is say, in terms of crypto, if we don't teach new people cryptology or cryptography, then the current generation will retire and we don't have any crypto experts anymore, and that would be a terrible thing, right? Same for databases, same for synchronization. So I'd like to make you synchronization experts. And if at the end you say, well, I don't care about any of this, I'll just use CouchDB, good. If you know, well, I don't like CouchDB, but now I know all the things that go into designing a reliable synchronization system, and then you know now what to do and how complicated it actually is. And the edge cases to think about. So we're going through over the four ingredients that you need baseline for this now. So this is where the actual talk starts. The people who were zoning out through the intro that you saw yesterday, please wake up again. The first thing you need is to be able to uniquely identify a data record. And now this is databases 101. First thing we learn there is that you can use natural keys. For example, in this data set, the last name is a good primary key. If I see Ablesworth, I know which record I'm using here. It's very nice. I don't. It's very convenient to do this. Say we have a new data record in here. Maybe you can spot the problem that's about to come up. This is still a unique index. We're getting a Jane Doe in here. No, last name no longer is a good unique identifier for the data records here. So cool, next step is we just make the last name and first name combination our primary key. That'll solve everything, right? Now next Jane Doe comes in, and now we're screwed. So what database people have come up with is this thing called the surrogate key, something that is in like is a unique identifier for a data record, but that has nothing to do with the actual data. I assume you all know this. This is just for completeness sake. If you've seen a MySQL installation, auto increment is famous here. For every new record you put into the database, it gets a new ID, like an N plus one. It is unique, monotonically increasing. It works really well. But remember, CouchDB, I can have two or even more databases that I can have live traffic and writing traffic to. So I have a database on the left and a database on the right. I have seven records, and the one gets an eighth Eric Erickson, and the other one gets an eighth Ethel Easterbro. So I have two totally different records, and they get the same primary key here. So that's no good. We don't want this. That's not a good solution. What is current best practice for this is using UUIDs. Usually 32-bit unique strings that are globally unique. It doesn't matter where I produce them, it's going to be unique, and there's enough of them in this key space for everyone and everyone's friends and all the stars in the world and all the sand on all the beaches on the world, on planet Earth and all that kind of stuff. So it's big enough for everyone. And now I have a nice one-to-one, like a unique mapping that is independent of the database I run it. The downside is immediately obvious. Take a lot more storage space. You can see this nicely illustrated in my table here. This is intentional, of course. Say we identify who this John Doe is and put in the actual name. We can do this without losing our association to the primary key. If the last name were our primary key, the name change couldn't be modeled in our system, which would be kind of would defeat the purpose of tracking people. So UUID allows us name changes and everything else and still retain the identity of our object. They're hard to remember. In the early days of the internet, people prided themselves having short ICQ numbers. If you're one of those, you still remember your six-digit ICQ number, good for you. Phone numbers are another thing that people use but are very hard to remember. But this is overall good. We are using UUIDs here. So for a synchronization system, the first thing we need to do is have as a system of identity. We're using UUIDs. We've learned the trade-offs of having or not having them. So we're good. This is good. Second ingredient, we need to know what is new. Say we have a database and we want to synchronize it to another database. The first thing we need to be able to do is send all the documents that are in the one database to the other one. And here it's simple. We just go through our table, send this one, 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 send this one. That's good. But now say we're adding a new one down here, and then we synchronize again. So we just go through the list again, send this and 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 this. And this. But we've sent these already. Why are we sending them again? That's annoying, wasteful. We shouldn't be doing this. We should be able to calculate a delta. And you can see, and this is how it is in Couch, the database is sorted by primary key. If I'm adding a new record before the age, before the A over here, then I can't just go at the end and like just look after here. So I need to figure out how to, like, in from this list, I can't see in which order they arrived here or in which new order, new records will have arrived. So we'll have to have another index that tells this. I'm shortening down things a little bit here. So this is our database now, and this is a secondary index. For CouchDB, this is maintained for you in the main database. It's called the bisequence index, and it is an in the simplified sense, a monotonically increasing integer. In CouchDB 2, it's actually monotonically increasing string, but the properties are the same. And from here we can see we've written document CA7 first, then the DFF, then A0D, and then BE2. And it produces this list, which in the by ID index is sorted by ID. But here we know the order that happened. So now when we replicate, when I say replication, that's how the underlying technology in CouchDB is called. I'm using sync because that's more generally applicable to this. But when I say replication, I mean sync. And when I say sync, I mean replication. So now we have two databases, A to B, and I want to move everything from A to B. And all I have to do is traverse the bisequence index. I'm going to, for the first one, find it in the main database, and then move it over. Go to the second one, find it in the main database, move it over. Find the third one, find it in the database, move it over, and the fourth as well. And I'm also storing on the target that I am on the update sequence 4. We call this the high water mark. This is how far we got. Now, if we're writing a new record on database A, we're getting a new entry in the bisequence index with the index number 5. It's this one. And now when I'm doing replication, I can say database B already has the high water mark for database A at 4. Give me everything since 4. And since this is an index, it's very efficient to just jump to here and give me back everything that comes after this. So it's very easy to jump over to here. So all I can do then is find this record, move it over, and I only ever have to do synchronize new records over to the database. Instead of all over again, or have to compare one by one. Do I have this? No. Do I have this? Yes. Do I have this? No. And so on. So this makes delta calculation very efficient. The next thing we have to consider is updates. Very briefly, say we have identified John Doe. His real name is John Easter Hayes. I'm signifying that it's a new version here with a star. This gets a new update sequence here, as well, like an entry in the update sequence index as well as update sequence 6. The new ID with a star. And when I now make a request, like say synchronize again with high watermark 5, I only get the update here. The update gets applied over here, as we see. And now we have that thing, the update synchronized as well. So updates are just new entries in our update sequence table or index. Now, say we're going back to high watermark 5, so it's still John Doe over there, and it turns out we made a typo. The name isn't actually John Easter Hayes, it's John Easter Hose. But first we put in Easter Hayes, and then we change it to Easter Hose. It's a different version here, 2-star. We have 2 entries in our update sequence index, 1-star and 2-star, and now we're replicating or synchronizing again. From high watermark 5, CouchDB would go and say, okay, entry number 6 comes after 5, find this version in the database. Like first, like in this model, you can't find this anymore. This would still be available at that point, but you will move that over, and then you have go on to 7 and move this one over. Or wouldn't it be, you wonder, more efficient to just move over the 7th change here because we don't need the in-between one that was an error. We don't need to synchronize that if we already know we're going to end up with the other one. And that's exactly what happens in CouchDB. On the bisequence index, it's not only the monotonically increasing key or update sequence here, but also the list of document IDs in here is unique. So in reality, when we're writing the second version of this of the E32 record, CouchDB will take out the entries 5 and 6 at this point. Maybe the numbering is wrong. This should be 6. I'm sorry. It takes out entry number 5 because it refers to the previous version of the record E32. And then only move the one over. So if we have a lot of updates in between synchronization, only the latest update gets synchronized over, not all the in-between states. This is where it's a little different from Git, where you also want all the in-between states because you want to be able to potentially vert or operate on any one of the in-betweens. In CouchDB, this doesn't happen. All right, next one is deletions. How do you handle deletes? Well, in CouchDB, a delete is just an update. So when we say we're deleting the CA7 record, all we get is a new entry in our update sequence index, number 8, with the notion that CA7 is now deleted. And when I now do a synchronization from A to B, say give me everything from high watermark 7, I get the delete over, so all I do is strike out the information in database B. And it's a special case as well. This data isn't deleted in CouchDB, it's just marked as deleted. What we're considering here is the synchronization from just A to B, but remember you can use CouchDB in any which topology you want. So maybe there's a bunch of more databases. And if you want to synchronize B to C, and it also has this record, you need to tell this the C database also to delete it. So we're tracking deletes as well. So once you write a record into CouchDB, we'll keep it around forever, even if you delete it. The information that a document ID has existed will be in CouchDB forever. All right. So as far as ingredients is, we have identity, and we know what happened since. We can build efficient deltas, we can handle updates, and we can handle deletes. That's also already two things to get us onto proficiency with synchronization. Right, that was a lot of information, in a very little time. So I'll have a drink, and you can think of questions so far. Yes.
Like I understood, is you are having basically a secret information. You have some kind of V-log to synchronize different replicas. I see like two things here. One is you mentioned before about consistency and so on. I mean, with this approach, you can only assure that both replicas will eventually be consistent. I mean, unless you use synchronous replication, you cannot assume that both replicas are okay, let's say, at the same time. And the other thing related is, does this scale? Because if you have very big amount of replication, and you have a big log in a sequence, at the end you need to process it a single thread, or in order to keep consistency, so...
All right, so we didn't have the micro... Right, the first one is an observation of this, and we haven't gone through all of this, of course, but with this model, keeping a write log and using that for synchronization, all you ever can be able to do is offer eventual consistency over all the nodes that participate. That is correct. We're not trying to pretend that any other way is possible. And I'll go into details of why we're making that design choice later, because it's very hard to do the other consistency. The other thing was what was the question? Oh yeah, the scalability of the replication. So if there's lots of entries in any one of them, lots of them going on in parallel, all of this can happen online, as many as you need going on concurrently. All of these are like the log is per node, obviously, but then the high watermark is per source target combination. You can have them going in both directions at the same time. You can have them going in real time. You can have that with 5, 10, 100 1,000 databases going on. There's a few like internal implementation optimizations that we can make so that idle databases don't cost any CPU time. That goes way, way into the details. But this scales, yes. Yeah. Cool, yes. All right, we'll get to that. Well, you had a question too? So I don't think I get the question correctly. Like you wanted to change the behavior of the delete?
No, what I'm saying is if you have to comply. So sorry for yelling. Ah. If you have to comply with the data retention policy, where you should not keep the data, do you make sure that data is actually wiped from
right.
the database?
Okay, so there's a special operation called purge. So if you've accidentally publicized your credit card number or social security number or something like this, that is for emergency situations. It's not part of your regular application workflow. You can the actual data. So if you need to be sure that data is gone, you can delete it. The only thing that we retain is that ID has existed before. If that's good enough for you, that works. If you use UIDs, that should be fine. The actual associated data will be deleted. And you can also leave so-called tombstone information here. So say, okay, this data record was deleted because of data retention policy so-and-so. So you can still see this in the deleted record, but not the actual data. That okay. was the question.
Thank you.
Cool. All right. No question. Good. All right. Next, versions. So currently, previously I used the star and the double star to say that here's a different version of a document ID. So we need to look at the nature of versions again a little bit. And here again, auto increment is kind of the natural choice that we do here. We have a database. Instead of just tracking the ID, we're tracking the ID and the version. And CouchDB does this for you in Couch. This is called revision instead of version. It's the same thing. Again, I don't know why English has so many words for the same thing. If I want to move that to database B, that also gets version 1. That's very nice. There's an obvious problem here. Say we change this new version. Database A gets Antonio Bubblesworth, and database B gets Antonio Wibblesworth. Now we have the same version ID or the same version for two different records as problem. So auto increment is out again. But what's nice about what would be nice about an auto increment? Again, it's strictly ordered, or in math terms, is monotonically increasing. So what else is monotonically increasing? Any guess? Bam! All right. So this is a 5-minute comedy hour. There's two blog posts called The Falsehoods Programmers Believe About Time and its Sequel. There are about 100 statements about what programmers think what time works in distributed systems, and they're all false. I've got the top 20 with me that is relevant for our discussion. So this is the more lighthearted. So I have links are in the slides later if you get the PDFs. So remember, all of the statements that I'm going to make in the next couple of minutes are false. The system clock will always be set to the correct local time. The system clock will always be set to a time that's not wildly different from the correct local time. If the system clock is incorrect, it will at least be always off by a consistent number of seconds. The server clock and the client clock will always be set to the same time. The server clock and the client clock will always be set around the same time. Okay, but the time on the server clock and the time on the client clock would never be different by a matter of decades. If the server clock and the client clock are not in sync, they will at least be out of sync by a consistent number of seconds. The server clock and the client clock will always use the same time zone. The system, again, he chuckles, it's good. The system clock will never be set to a time that is in the distant past or far future. 1 minute on the system clock has exactly the same duration as 1 minute on another clock. Okay, but the duration of 1 minute on the system clock will be pretty close to the duration of 1 minute in most other clocks. Fine, but the duration of 1 minute on the system clock would never be more than 1 hour. A timestamp of sufficient precision can safely be considered unique. this is relevant for our discussions. They use timestamps, you know, they're absolutely, if it's microseconds and then I have two humans clicking the button at the same time, how likely is that? Well, as soon as you have computers involved, it gets very likely very quickly. It is possible to establish a total ordering on timestamp that is useful outside your system. This is also relevant for our discussion of producing different or same revisions in different nodes. Timestamps always advance monotonically. Also not correct. My software is only used internally or locally, so I don't have to worry about time zones. My software stack will handle time zones without me needing to do anything special. And this is the last two, my favorite ones. All measurement of time on a given clock will occur within the same frame of reference. We're getting into Einstein territory. In other words, time passes at the same speed on top of a mountain and the bottom of a valley. That's also not correct. None of these things are true. So timestamps, no. Two more anecdotes for this. Google has built and published a paper on database system. It's a globally distributed, SQL-compatible, consistent database, CA, not CP, called Spanner. It's a fascinating paper. Most of this is discussing how they work around all these limitations. So you can work around them if you have Google-level engineering resources. But nobody has them, so not a solution for you. Also, a little further while back, Google had issues with their two-factor authentication system because one of their servers' time settings were off, so the 2FA tokens were no longer valid, so people couldn't log into their system. So they don't even get that rolled out internally or across all the systems.
People can't get to Google on their Android phone, which is almost always because the clock is wrong in a way that they've never come across before.
Yes, but it would never happen to you. Right? Now, that's the usual discussion, but yeah. It will happen to you.
Yeah, but for anyone who's interested in some more examples of this, dig out that talk and right. Beep.
Oh, Jesus, where's my... That's not what I want. Give me a second. I'm supposed to have a cursor here so I can scroll, but that is gone for some... Ah, there we are. Some of the reasons, not logging in or not accessing their Google accounts is one thing. You've all had the scenario where you're syncing your address book from your phone to your computer and suddenly you have twice the number of contacts and everyone's the double or three times with three devices. Or you keep editing one on the phone, but the edit never shows up on the desktop or the other way around. These are all scenarios of using either time or differently insufficient ways of marking versions in a distributed system. One of my favorite ones is writing shortcuts on the Mac ecosystem on iCloud. So if I say, I'm on my way, I can say OMW and will write on my way. And these are synchronized across all my iCloud accounts. The system has an error condition for some users where when you add one on the phone, it gets deleted from the system again when it tries to sync. It's really useful. And for the other one is when you delete one on the desktop, when it syncs, it gets added again. So you can never think. It's clearly something is off. So whenever, and you've all experienced this. I know like you don't need to do a show of hands. You've all experienced some form of this. You're well aware of the symptoms where this what comes out of this. In terms of other databases that say that they do synchronization, their usual solution for this... Oh, actually, let's get into this later, maybe. So before we can learn about how to improve on timestamps, we need to do a little bit of an interlude. This is about distributed systems. And as soon as you have two computers connected with a network, you have a distributed system. And it's that dire to have a distributed system, sorry. And there are different rules in distributed systems. And there is a way of pretending those rules don't exist, and that's how you get synchronization errors, for example. And that's a way to like embracing them and working with them and building reliable systems that work across unreliable networks. If you want to have another laugh, I don't have them listed here, but there's a list of fallacies of distributed network computing that are really fun too. This is from the early 80s or late 70s from one of the founders of Sun at the time. It's really, really fun reading to see all the problems that can happen within networks. So this is a slide from earlier. We said versions that signify the same version of a record but have actually different content are a bad idea. In distributed systems terms, this is a conflict. A conflict in distributed systems is one of the rules, one of the things that just exist. A conflict is a natural state in a distributed system. And there's no way around that. You cannot like, we all as programmers, we're trained to not like conflicts, right? We're meant to avoid conflicts. But the only way to handle this reliably is to embrace them. We all know this, right? So this is made sure to not compile ever. We hopefully don't ever check this in. but this is a local conflict in a version control system. In a database scenario, though, you can't mark a record as not available because it is in conflict. You need to do something. And we'll learn what you can do now later. So, one of the things where other databases try to ignore that they are working with distributed systems, you've all seen this as well, I think, is you have database replication going on, and your ops people get, like, your developers get nervous, and your ops people get nervous because they have to monitor the replication lag so they know how much the secondary is behind to pretend, to keep that as small as possible, to pretend they are on the same machine because that's what the consistency model of the application expects. Of course, this is fraught with peril. Don't go there. So conflicts are cool. At least two people get the reference. I like that. Good. So what's better than timestamps? Any guesses? Vector clocks or Lampert timestamps. So not the things that are monotonically increasing, but not based on a clock, but based on a logical... based on logic, I guess. So vector clocks or Lampert timestamps are shared common state plus increments. So you know what happened after what in a distributed systems. You can synchronize the starting state and then move forward independently and know what happened after what, which is important for what we need to know. So which version came after which other version. But there's no representation of when each change actually happened in a clock time sense. And that's a good thing. We don't want to know this. For CouchDB, vector clocks aren't really useful. And this is a slide from the other talk. So if you've never seen a Dynamo system, this is going to be the 30-second introduction to clustered databases with Dynamo. In this scenario, we are writing the document A, B, and C to our database cluster that has the three nodes. And all three nodes have a shard and a backup shard and a backup shard of the same database. We're giving it the parameter n equals 3, which means to satisfy this request successfully, CouchDB need to talk to at least three nodes in the system to say it is to have committed the data on disk for the write to be successful. So if we were using vector clocks at this point, maybe they even share the same state. Creating the document here and here and here independently would create different versions inside the vector clock. So I would create a three-way conflict with each write on the system. There would be a way of reconciling this. There's other databases that use vector clocks for this reason. They have reconciling logic after the fact. CouchDB goes another way. So in vector clocks, has a lot of advantages, but has this one advantage. The same edit on different nodes creates a different version. And that's something that we want to avoid. So CouchDB uses what we call content addressable versions. This is a version hash built from the contents of the current version of the doc. It currently is an MD5 hash, which is obviously on the way out. This is not used for any security purposes, so it's not a problem as such. But this is something we are reconsidering in the design, but that's, again, a design detail that doesn't make the protocol any worse. The problem is, if you have a content addressable hash, it's no longer ordered. You don't know which one came after which other one. So, and this is where it's really annoying that we can't use vector clocks, because that property is built into the hash of the time, the logical timestamp we're getting. In CouchDB, we solve it by storing these in a list. So when we create a new document, gets version A, make an update version B, make an update version C, D, and E. And what we're storing here is not actually, this is now version E, but this is version E, which we know comes after D, which we know comes after C. And again, the actual data that lives with these revisions, CouchDB doesn't store perpetually, only the data that comes with the last revision, but we forever keep the history of version ID so we know which one came after which other one, and why that becomes clear in a second. So yeah, this is not as elegant as vector clocks, but it's the only way to make fix this issue for us. Of course, in the database, you can have unlimited number of updates for a record. So there needs to be, well, this is an unbounded list at this point, so there needs to be a limit. CouchDB revision or version limit is 1,000 by default. So you can diverge by 999 versions and then still reconcile a version update across nodes. You can set that per database if you want to change it per database, how long you want this to be. You can keep this shorter or longer depending on how much divergence you expect in the system and how much storage space you want to give out to this. The worst case scenario, that a conflict is created if you don't have enough shared history to see that you can merge again. But then again, conflicts are cool. We already know this. So that isn't a problem. We already know how to deal with those. So let's see the whole system in work. So database on the left side, database on the right side. We've already learned how to do the... Here's the delta update for the list of documents that I have. Now I'm looking at just one document and its updates and how they replicate. So I'm creating a document, document one, with revision A. I'll omit the revision tag here for the future. We're writing a new version. And again, we're not writing version B, but we are writing version B that we know comes after A. Next, we're writing version C that we know comes after B, comes after A. And then we replicate, and again, we only replicate the latest version off to the other database. So the new database on the right now gets document one with version C that it also knows came after B and came after A, but the other database never knew what B or A were. It only knew that they existed. And maybe you can reverse engineer that by doing MD5 hash collisions if it wanted to, but we're not here. So since I can write to any database at any time, I can create a new version on the right database, version D that we know comes after C, and another one, E, and then I can replicate it back to the other one. And since I know that the current revision on this document is CBA and that E, so the version here has CBA as a common ancestor here, I know that the version E that comes after D that comes after CBA can be accepted as the new latest revision here. In Git terms, this is a fast forward. And again, With the revision limit that we have, you can have 1,000 or 999 edits on this side and still get the synchronized over and make it a fast forward. And again, you can have a trade-off of space requirement and how often you want to deal with these conflicts if you want to change that. So, writing a new version on database A, and this is where the fun part happens, a version F, and then version H on the other side, and we're replicating, again, what happens now. Dun, 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 dramatic pause. CouchD will keep both versions. It will detect that they have a common ancestry, EDCBA, and it will pick one of the versions that come in as the winning revision, because again, we can't mark in an online database, we can't mark revisions as gone. But it is marked as conflict. If the conflict then is replicated around all the other nodes, all nodes independently will also choose the same, we call them winning revisions, but all the losing revisions are also kept around. This is what this looks in Couch. Your documents are in JSON, the document ID is one, you get a new member underscore conflict with an array of all the conflicting revisions. And then it's up to the application to decide, do I take F, I delete H, do I take H, I delete F, do I read both and merge them and with application-specific logic and write them as a new one, J, as the solution for the conflict? Again, if the conflict happens on multiple nodes and I solve it on one node and then replicate again, that solution is also a fast forward for the solution of the same conflict on all the other nodes, which again ensures the eventual consistency properties that we've previously established we'd like to have. I'm realizing now you earlier asked about deletes. This isn't tracked any specially here. I'll explain any specially here, but we learned earlier that deletes are just other versions. So this could, in fact, be a delete. And we know here, okay, I updated this and I deleted it. So it's just a property of the actual version. So it doesn't change anything in this system here. So we're tracking deletes just as any other version update. For efficient storage of this, CouchDB, so as you can imagine, like this is obviously a list, and this is a list with a special member that's also a list. If you've done computer science, you've seen this notation before. This is obviously a tree. In CouchDB, it's called the revision tree. That's the one of the most complicated parts of the CouchDB source code, making that work properly and efficiently. If you ever want to look at that. Okay, so summing up, the ingredients for successful synchronization is identity. You need to know what happened since. You need to be able to calculate deltas, handle updates and deletes in the same way. You need to absolutely embrace conflicts. There's no other way. Don't let anyone tell anyone anything. Tell you anything else. And you have a choice of different versioning schemes, and there are different ones like vector clocks or our list of content addressable versions, and depending on your needs, you can pick either one of those. I'm not going to say one is better than the other. I'm just explaining the trade-offs of why we're not choosing vector clocks here. I have a few more minutes, so there's a bit of bonus material. Other ways of synchronizing data, which is usually the first next questions that are coming from you, so I've anticipated this. The one is called operational transforms. This is what's used in Etherpad and Google Docs and was used in Google Wave. This is really good to synchronize usually connected or casually connected clients doing text collaboration. It's really good for that. Once you're out of sync for more than a minute, you need to be very clever with the implementation to keep it efficient and fast. But also, if you have a large group editing very fast, having someone come in after a minute and they had a lot of offline edits, it can be very confusing to have them merge into the current text stream. It'll still work out from the system or takes all the CPU and confuses all the users. So usually these systems say after a minute, well, now you're working offline, like you can't do this anymore, like reload the page and edit this manually, which is a totally fine trade-off, but isn't a generic data synchronization model. But if you do anything real-timey, text-y, look at operational transforms. They're very nice. I mentioned their work. All right, so mentioned the trade-offs here. The next one is CRDTs, or conflict-free replicated data types. These are specific data types designed for distributed systems that don't have conflicts. And everybody goes like, ooh, that's nice. That's really cool. The downside is they're very specific data types. There's like lists and trees and hashes and counters and that kind of stuff. And they all have special and non-standard properties. So a CRDT hash doesn't work like a Java hash, right? Or a tree or any of the other ones. So you need to be aware of the semantics of what the CRDT data type actually works like and if that works for your program. So it's slightly different. If you have a problem that can be modeled with a CRDT, they're really good. So definitely look into those if you want. That's really nice. And the last one I wanted to mention is a new paper that came out this summer. I hadn't had time to read it yet. It's conflict-free replication to JSON data type. And it promises to bring a bunch of ideas from operational transform and CRDTs into a more generic JSON data type. And again, I haven't had time to read this, but this is the most advanced of any of the things in the area. Again, has no conflicts. It is very new. It probably at some point has the same trade-offs where it says, okay, this looks like a JSON, but it behaves slightly differently in these cases. So you, I couldn't even make up an example. Like it would be slightly non-standard. But again, do look at this. The links to all the other stuff is also in the appendix. The PDF will be online and everything. So definitely look at this paper. This is like the cutting edge research for this kind of stuff. So if this is a really good thing, we're definitely going to build this into Couch. With the CRDTs, this kind of layer on top, operational transforms, CouchDB is unlikely to ever get, just for the scope of what we're using things for. So I know how, hope you know all about the things that you need to build a reliable synchronization engine. You may not want to worry about any of these. There's a few, very few details that I've omitted, and I mentioned the conflict resolution things. We're also tracking deleted conflicts, because that's also a thing that needs to propagate through the cluster. That complex just another level of indirection in there. But that's about it. So you're now qualified to see if a system does good synchronization. If it uses timestamp, you can also... like almost always say, no, it doesn't do a good way of working correctly. And you'll be able to build your own or pick from parts to build your own synchronization system that fits your specific needs. Thank you very much. All right, we have another minute for questions if you want, but I'll be around all day. We have 1 minute for questions. But also, I'll be around all day. I have, if you're here for ApacheCon, I have 2 more talks today. There's somewhat about CouchDB as well, if you're interested.
What is the mechanism to provide to the applications in order to make the merge? I mean, there is a conflict. You said, okay, the application will. Do you notify it? Do you come to plugins?
All right. So the question is, how does the application get notified about conflicts? Whenever you make a read request, your application can see it. Does it have the conflict member in there or not? That's the default. Plus, I've mentioned in the beginning very briefly the changes feed. You can subscribe to all the changes that come into the database, and you can filter this as well, programmatic or declaratively, and say only like give me a real-time feed of all the conflicts that are being written into the database. And then you can listen to this as an HTTP socket and have an asynchronous process just to go in and resolve these as much as you can. I don't actually know. And so how does it look in the tree diagram? I would have to look up what the specifics of this is. It might be that you write the new version and then you have to delete the other ones to make sure it's a list again. As soon as you have diverging leaf nodes, we know there is a conflict and can be an arbitrarily nested a tree of conflicts. And you can traverse the tree to make sure you get them all. So you know you can solve all the conflicts eventually. But what that actually looks like in terms of the tree structure, I would have to look it up. All right, that's the time. I'll be around. Thank you very much for your time, and good luck building sync systems.